This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
I'm Alex Smith with three key stories from three hosts. In the USA, I'll talk to John D. Steinbrenner about a new report to the CIA on disruptive climate change. Radio EcoShock Washington correspondent Jerry Williams talks with Jonathan Kaufman of Earth Rights International. Why do big oil companies pay for spills in developed countries and get away with murder in Nigeria? Then radio host Daphne Washam reports on the fantastic growth of renewable energy in Germany. She's in Berlin with expert Hans Verholm. A new report to the CIA advises them to prepare for disruption in a warming world. The title of the assessment from the National Research Council is Climate and Social Stress: Implications for Security Analysis. In a strange irony, presentation of this report to the CIA was temporarily postponed as the Capitol closed down due to a violent storm, Hurricane Sandy. Our guest is John D. Steinbrenner. He's a professor of public policy at the University of Maryland and chairs the 14-member panel of experts who conducted the analysis for the intelligence community. Dr. Steinbrenner, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much.
Who is the intended audience for this report?
It's the U.S. government as a whole, basically. What we're trying to say is that the issue of global warming is extremely serious, and it promises to have severe disruptive effects in countries we care about, and that it is important for the government to begin monitoring both climate variables and social variables much more systematically than they're currently doing to anticipate trouble before it fully ripens.
Well, can you give us an example of a climate security threat that may have already occurred?
I can give you an example of one that is in chronic infection mode, and we mentioned that in the report, and that is Pakistan, which is clearly an internally fragile society, and it's being subjected to very severe pressure due to reduced flows in the Indus River Valley, which moderately complicated story, but it has to do with the dynamics of glacier melt in the Karakoram glaciers in the Himalayas. That is subjecting the reduced flows in the river, is suggesting Pakistan to severe internal pressures because they rely on hydroelectric power generation in large parts of the country, and they also rely on water for irrigation purposes, and they're really favoring irrigation over power generation. As a result, they're getting daily or weekly, even daily riots in Pakistani villages about power outages. And there is also internal tension associated with the allocation rules for irrigation favoring the Punjab over the Sindh. Sindh is a much more arid province. And so we see the Pakistan government under increasingly severe pressure and basically not handling it all that well. And that's the type of situation we need to worry about.
Well, it's interesting you bring up Pakistan. I've been thinking about that because in the floods of 2010, which covered an estimated 1/5 of the land area, and it's a nuclear-armed country, there could have been more social breakdown. But my understanding from people who were there was that the government looked after its own supporters first and may have been strengthened by disruption in areas where they had weak control anyway. So, and another example of that same thing is U.S. hurricanes. We could say the poor response of the Bush administration weakened the federal government, while Obama's team response may have strengthened at least public perception of the necessity of a strong central government. So these events might play either way, making a government stronger or weaker. What's your thoughts on that?
We're making that point, exactly that. The net consequence of a severe climate event has a lot to do with the social reaction broadly defined. That's the coping capacity of the people immediately affected and the government's response, the responsible government's response to it. Yes, an effective response can actually strengthen governments. Part of our point is, however, is that there is good reason to expect events that are a good bit more severe than anything yet on record. And we can hope that all the government responses are going to be equitable and effective, but the chances are that some of them won't be, and we need to get prepared for the consequences of that latter situation. But we do not know, unfortunately, the timing, magnitude, location, all the particulars with sufficient precision to make confident predictions. And so what we're saying is you have to look for trouble. You have to expect it to occur. Trouble of a magnitude we haven't encountered yet before, so something beyond recent experience or any experience. We need to monitor more carefully to pick it up earlier so that we don't sort of get too surprised and that we're prepared. It's a very abstract argument, and sort of going outside the bounds of experience and saying there's reason to do that, but, you know, it's difficult, I imagine, for people to, it's an abstraction, and it's difficult for them to absorb.
Well, yes, indeed. The National Research Council talks about, quote, climate surprises in the decades to come. And I can see things like that. We could have frozen methane on the sea floor. The clathrates could suddenly melt. We might have a burst of warming we didn't look for. Would you elaborate on this idea of climate surprises?
We were looking at adaptation issues rather than mitigation. When you're talking about sort of the release of frozen methane on the seafloor, that is, we put in the category of a tipping event, sort of passing a threshold where suddenly you get a feedback process that really makes the whole situation globally a lot more dangerous. We looked hard at that, and we had to admit that there's no scientific basis for projecting such an event within the next decade. Our time frame was within a decade. So what we did is said, however, we do know enough to say that we should expect adaptation difficulties in some places over the course of a decade, and then with increasing frequency and severity thereafter. And adaptation is more a localized effect, a climate effect that is focused in a particular area, even though there may be global consequences to it. And it, again, carries the affected societies outside the bounds of their coping capability. So that's a narrower view than the more global view of potentially globally catastrophic tipping effects.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We're talking about the American intelligence community and their need to prepare for extreme climate events as a national security problem. Professor John D. Steinbruner is also director of the Center for International and Security Studies at Maryland. John, other military analysts have long suggested the next major war may be triggered over water shortages and water access. You did talk about Pakistan. Does global warming make that threat more serious?
Global warming certainly is affecting water dynamics, and these have very big consequences for societies. The interaction of water issues can exacerbate tensions that already exist, particularly, for example, between India and Pakistan over water flows in the Indus River. Pakistan government actually blames India for the reduced flow in the river, even though the evidence suggests that it is a climate change phenomenon. So it is playing into a relationship that is already tense.
Well, Dr. Steinbruner, before releasing the report, your group presented it to the CIA. Did you get some interest, and is there any way to judge how seriously the CIA or even, say, Homeland Security take climate disruption?
Well, let me say that the target of the report was not just the CIA, it was the entire intelligence community and indeed the entire government. But yes, I would say that those parts of the government that are involved in security issues are very attentive. I mean, it's not difficult to get their attention. They understand that this potential issue is very serious. Naturally enough, they want specificity. They need to know, okay, what specifically might happen, what kind of problems do. And it's, of course, difficult to give them specificity based upon what we really know at the moment. So basically what we're saying to them is the government as a whole needs to do more refined, more careful, more systematic monitoring of this unfolding story. And if you do that, you will have, with better evidence, we will be able to inform you better. It's an interaction between what we know and what we can measure.
And what role could the intelligence community play in that? How can they adapt?
Well, the intelligence community obviously has major assets for gathering data. And part of what we're saying is combine yourself, align with the scientific community to work out what data we most need to gather and how we ought to use it. Put yourself and the rest of the government in a better position to understand the story as it unfolds. And, you know, part of the message is you cannot do this only by yourself with your traditional secretive methods. Okay, this is a global problem, a global story. It's going to require globally vetted, globally authorized arrangements, and we need to start doing that.
Right, because, you know, I worry whether the intelligence agencies even if they see something coming for a particular government, would they share it with other government agencies and the public? As we learned from 9/11, critical information can become compartmentalized. And right now, governments in some countries are either publicly denying climate change or trying to avoid talking about it. If their intelligence agencies see a real threat, would the public even find out in time to protect themselves?
Yeah, that is a real issue. I mean, and this is, I think, really a fundamental problem maybe with American culture as a whole. We have problems sharing. There's something about American childbearing practices that are a little defective in that regard. And what we're trying to say is you've got to share information here, not only within the government, but with globally, okay? If you want to set up a monitoring system, everybody is going to have to contribute to it and get benefit from it, which means that we have to agree on what it is we're monitoring and why we're doing it and how we do it and all that. And access is going to have to be equitable. You cannot just restrict it to any national intelligence agency. You know, just being a little specific for a moment, the U.S., of course, is very interested in precipitation in South Asia. It's one of the things we know we need to monitor. We do this with satellites, okay, but we don't get enough precision with that without ground station monitoring data, which neither India or Pakistan will give to us. India wants to sell it, which violates our sense of how this should work, and Pakistan classifies the information. So we've got a lot of discussing to go to set up an arrangement where everybody agrees to provide detailed data and gets commensurate benefits from the aggregate system. There's a lot of talk and institutional organization in front of us to set up an arrangement of that sort, and we're telling the intelligence communities that's the way you've got to think about it, not in your normal secretive way, but in an open, globally vetted way.
Well, on a more personal level, John Steinbruner, you blogged about a book by Fred Gutterill, the executive director of Scientific American. It's called Fate of the Species, Why the Human Race May Cause Its Own Extinction and How We Can Stop It. I'm wondering, did the NRC or have you thought about the possibility that runaway climate change could bring about human extinction?
It's a possibility we cannot exclude. That's what I would say. We are adding CO2 to the atmosphere at a rate that exceeds anything we've seen in the entire 65 million year paleoclimate record. We've never added at this rate ever. And that means that we're providing a thermal impulse that will have to be balanced in some way at an unprecedented rate. And that says we're looking at big events here, the possibility of big events. So you cannot preclude that the consequences are large enough to put, you know, the viability of the species in question. Nobody believes that's a short-term question. If that proved to be a short-term question, we would all be stunned and astounded. But it is a long-term question, and we're not yet prepared to cope with it. So the warning is well taken. The last part of the book, how to keep it from happening, there's not much in the book about that. And it's not his fault. It's that there's not much to say as yet about that. We don't yet know or have not yet organized what we need to do to preclude this possibility. But we're trying to say, basically, this is a very big deal. It's going to have major consequences. We're going to have to deal with it much more in greater detail and much more seriously than we're currently doing. And the Gutterill warning helps in that regard to the extent anybody pays attention to it.
Well, in a surprise, you found climate instability may not be totally bad. Tyrants may have a harder time, or maybe people will develop a larger sense of sharing. Talk to us about that.
I think there is a lot of constructive opportunity here, actually. There are definitely things that can be done. We could bring, if you will, the global warming impulse under control in, say, half a century by an organized transformation of energy generation globally. That'll ultimately have to be done anyway if we make a big deal of it. And by the way, that's a very productive way of diverting investment assets that I think are finding some difficulty being productive. It just requires thinking on a global scale and diverting, if you will, current energy markets off onto a different track by deliberate public action. It's a matter of, if you will, organizing public policy much more decisively on a much broader scale than we're used to doing. If we did do that, many things, many security issues could be substantially benefited, if you will. So it is an opportunity for reforming or sort of putting our international relationships on a much more productive basis. And if you will, recognizing a common interest that requires common action and requires it enough that it actually occurs. So there's a lot that is actually positive in this situation.
Well, I'm thinking, too, about people who are engulfed in a climate emergency, whether they're in Asia or in the Rockaways of New York. They may have to create an instant community of self-help. Maybe we'll see more localization and resilience developing as big weather events strike with more regularity. What are your thoughts on that?
That is certainly part of the story. When you're talking about these weather episodes such as Sandy, the resilience of the local community matters a whole lot. And the ability, if you will, to give help to local communities from remote locations is a major question. I mean, as we're seeing, we think that we responded to Sandy reasonably well, but the people in Brooklyn who are still without power don't think so, and they are right not to think so. So Sandy tells us that our ability, which we think is more advanced than some other places, is still not adequate to events of this magnitude. And therefore, we need to get better at it at all levels, locally, nationally, and globally. And the internet, the interaction, this sort of flow of information, potentially at any rate, helps in that regard. I was told, for example, I live in Washington, D.C., there was somebody in our neighborhood who was going around collecting food and blankets and other things and driving them up to New York to the neighborhoods in question, not waiting for government relief agencies to do this, just literally doing it on an individual basis. Enough people do that, it would make a difference.
Well, that is a plot I would like to see succeed. You have been listening to Radio EcoShock. We've been talking with Professor John D. Steinbruner about a report by the National Research Council for the American Intelligence Community and the government. It's titled Climate and Social Stress Implications for Security Analysis. You can find links to all that in my show blog at ecoshock.info. Professor Steinbruner, thank you for sharing your time with Radio EcoShock listeners.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed it.
I'm Alex Smith.
Radio EcoShock.
Now we turn to unreported news. Huge oil spills continue in Nigeria. American and European multinational companies are dodging the law and wreaking havoc with nature and local people. From the Washington studios of WPFW Pacifica Radio, EcoShock correspondent Jerry Williams reports.
We're talking today with Jonathan Kaufman. He is a staff attorney with Earth Rights International. He leads ERI's work on transparency and U.S. policy advocacy on international accountability mechanisms. Welcome to Radio EcoShock, Jonathan.
Thanks so much.
Well, we're going to talk a little bit today about what's happening with Nigeria. There's a big case that involves a giant oil company that is before an international court. But before we get into that, could you give a little bit of background about the extent and the duration of the oil operations in Nigeria and the companies involved, and what is the actual case that's being brought forward?
Well, oil has been extracted in the Niger Delta, in particular in Nigeria. So that's a large kind of swampy area in the southeast part of Nigeria since the 1950s, I think. And I think Shell has basically been in there from the beginning. I think that they've been the largest participant and they've been there from the beginning. By this time, you've got most of the major oil companies extracting oil in the Niger Delta. So that includes Chevron and Exxon, also Eni Agip, which is the big Italian company, Total, the French oil company as well. So most of the major oil companies in the world are pumping oil either in the creeks that are part of the swampland of the Niger Delta or offshore on platforms.
And I assume they've all been model citizens, that they have been, paragons and examples of environmental responsibility during these years.
Well, I wish I could say that was the case. The Niger Delta is often cited as one of the world's ecological disasters. You've had tremendous, tremendous oil spills there that generally go uncleaned for decades. And this kind of came to light, and you started seeing it in headlines in, say, The Times and The Washington Post during the big BP oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. And people suddenly started to remember that there are a lot of places around the world that have been dealing with this kind of thing for decades. the comparison is really striking. You know, BP has a disastrous spill in the Gulf of Mexico, one of the largest in history. And now, you know, they immediately agreed to put aside billions and billions of dollars for reparations to fishermen and to rehabilitate the ecosystem. The U.S. government is prosecuting them again to the tune of billions of dollars. Meanwhile, in the Niger Delta, you've had millions and millions of gallons of oil spilled over the course of 50, 60 years. And the locals have to fight tooth and nail to get anyone even to recognize what's happened.
I had been looking at the summary of a report last year from the UN Environmental Program that talked about a three-year investigation in which it was found that there was heavy contamination in Nigeria of land and underground water. Sometimes more than 40 years after it had been spilled, community drinking water with dangerous concentrations of benzenes and other pollutants, soil contaminated so farming can't take place. And what I find most damning was that there was evidence that most of the spill sites that the firms had claimed to have cleaned up are still highly contaminated. And so they have failed even to meet their own standards for cleanup. And also of Nigeria's own standards, which brings up the situation in which the Nigerian government and the oil companies are really together, working together in ways that do not benefit the citizens of the country. Could you talk about their collaboration between the Nigerian forces and the government and Shell?
Sure. First of all, I do want to say that the Niger Delta is a very complicated area. And I don't want to minimize how difficult it is to operate and to have pipelines there. There are armed militants, there are criminal gangs, there's a lot of siphoning off of oil supplies. But whenever there's an oil spill, the first thing that the oil companies say is, it was sabotage. The communities did it. You know, they blew up the pipeline. They put an illegal tap into the pipe and it, you know, exploded and it created a rupture or whatever it is. And that is immediately the first thing that they say.
But you do concede that that does happen.
It absolutely happens. But it's also really important to point out that the Nigerian government doesn't have any independent capacity to investigate what causes these spills. The only information that they have comes from the oil companies themselves. Mm-hmm. So it shouldn't be surprising that very often in Nigerian official accounts, you see that it will say the overwhelming majority of oil spills are caused by sabotage and by communities, because it's the oil companies that are self-reporting. But whenever civil society groups go to check out the pipes, to check out the wellheads, the infrastructure, what they find is rusting, decaying pipes that should have been replaced years, if not decades ago, and plenty of evidence that it's in fact poor maintenance and poor upkeep, at least as much, if not more, than local sabotage. But as far as the way that the Nigerian government works with the oil companies, again, it's complicated. The Nigerian government depends very, very much on oil extraction for its revenue. I've seen statistics that say that Nigeria's foreign revenue that it receives, 90% or more depends on oil at this point. And what this does is it actually creates a break in accountability between the Nigerian government and the people. Because the Nigerian government gets tons of money to do what it needs to do, what it wants to do, to line the pockets of corrupt officials, completely regardless of what it gives its own people. It doesn't have to rely on its people for taxation. It doesn't have to get the approval of people, because their flow of money comes from foreign oil companies. And they can use that money to buy off opposition, to give around election time, to kind of give gifts to people to basically get short-term gain. There is a tremendous democratic problem in Nigeria that comes from the flow of oil money. I think maybe what you were referring to when you're asking me about the collaboration of security forces and oil companies, this has been a recurring problem. And it may be something that we see a little bit less of in recent years than we did 10, 15 years ago. But again, it's not gone. And what we saw in a couple of cases, including a case that we were involved in the federal courts here in the United States, was that Shell had a very symbiotic relationship with the police forces and the military forces during the military government of the 1990s. And essentially, our clients, the people that we represented, alleged that the two worked together to brutally repress opposition to the oil operations, which were causing such environmental damage and not bringing any benefits back to the communities.
Mm-hmm. It does seem as if human rights violations and environmental degradation go hand in hand when there's oil companies involved. But you had mentioned accountability. And in the case of the oil companies that are in Nigeria and elsewhere, they are nominally part of a particular country. You know, you mentioned an Italian oil company, BP is associated with Britain, and so forth. But these are multinational companies. And what kind of jurisdiction applies in these cases where these companies can cause such damage? Who assesses what the damage is and how can this be carried out?
Well, there are a few possibilities. Always, you have the potential of using the Nigerian courts. I'm not saying it's a great option, but it exists. And I've actually seen judgments from Nigerian courts finding that a company should be responsible for damage. One of the environmental abuses that we see most commonly, particularly from the oil companies that operate on land in the creeks in the Niger Delta, is gas flaring. This is a practice where when you extract oil from the ground, natural gas that is found in the same underground reservoirs bubbles out. The best practice, which is practiced almost everywhere in the world except for Nigeria and, ironically, North Dakota, is to capture that gas and use it for energy, because obviously natural gas is valuable and it can be used for energy. That does require some infrastructure and requires that oil companies would be willing to actually invest in the country, not like Nigeria, that they've been operating in for the last 50 years. If you don't have the infrastructure to capture this gas and to export it, you can reinject it back in the ground. And that is actually an environmentally responsible way of taking care of this gas. And it goes back under the ground. And it actually helps the oil companies because it helps to maintain the pressure from the underground reservoir so the oil can keep on coming out quickly. But what the oil companies do in Nigeria, by and large, is they burn it as it comes out of the ground. You have to understand that these flames are right in the middle of villages and communities. They're gigantic roaring flames that go 24 hours a day, spewing benzene and other toxins into the air. People believe that it causes elevated rates of lung problems, potentially cancer, skin problems. It poisons the water and the soil, and it goes day and night. And there was a lawsuit in Nigeria against Shell's Nigerian subsidiary in 2004, 2005. And you actually had a court coming out and saying that flaring gas was actually unconstitutional. It was a violation of the right to life because of the human impact that it had. The companies ignored it. They completely ignored the judgment. They continued to flare. The Nigerian government argued about it, talked about it, in the end gave Shell a deadline to stop flaring and then kept on extending the deadline, extending the deadline, extending the deadline. So it's been completely ignored. So Nigerian courts, technically, you could do something there. But the truth is that there's a lot of corruption. And even if you manage to get a positive outcome, often nothing comes of it. The case that you were talking about in the Netherlands, this is also a case against Shell. A benefit that you have about companies that come from Europe is that if your company is based in a European Union country, say the Netherlands, you can be sued in the Netherlands for something that you did anywhere in the world. And that's a rule across the European Union. This was a tremendous oil spill that took place maybe 10 years back, but really a really devastating oil spill. And the plaintiffs had very good evidence that this was not sabotage. This was caused by negligence, a failure to maintain the pipes.
These were farmers.
Their
land had been completely damaged and unusable, so they couldn't earn a living.
So when you have oil spills offshore, often it's a bit more subtle what kind of effects it has. You know, it will affect the fish population, and a lot of the people along the coast of Nigeria are fishermen. There's a tremendous Exxon oil spill a few years back where it wasn't detected for a little while, and oil was gushing out into a very rich fishery, and it killed off a lot of the fish. Exxon then used dispersants that would not be allowed in the United States that continued to poison the fisheries. And so the people along that part of shoreline are just completely out of luck. But when you have an oil spill in a wetland area where farmland is scarce and very precious, where particular trees have particular economic value, where people rely on the creeks to catch fish, the damage can be incalculable. I mean, you are talking about completely making it impossible for communities to continue living where they live because all of their means of survival are just wiped out.
When Radio EcoShock returns, corporations want to be persons at election time, but not when they fund oppression abroad. Find out more at our show blog at ecoshock.info.